This is Tribeca Talks, our favorite conversations recorded live at the Tribeca Film Festival. I'm Leah Sarbib. Good comedy is notoriously difficult to make. It has to feel seamless in order to work. But Paul Feig has mastered the genre. His career took off with cult favorite Freaks and Geeks. He's directed episodes of Arrested Development, Nurse Jackie, and The Office, which he also co-executive produced. His first hit film, Bridesmaids, was nominated for 2 Oscars. He went on to direct and produce the comedy Spy and to co-write and direct the acclaimed reboot of Ghostbusters. He sat down with SNL co-head writer, actor, and stand-up comedian Michael Che as part of our 2017 director series.
Hello, Tribeca. How are you guys?
Michael Che, everybody. Michael Che.
Hey. Hello. Paul Feig, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, honor. Now,
this is pretty exciting and nerve-wracking for me because I'm not qualified to be here. But no, it's interesting. So I'm just gonna ask you questions that I really wanted to know. Now, the first thing I want to ask you,
yes, sir,
is you're a stand-up as well.
Yeah, for back in the 80s.
Yeah.
Long time ago, Michael, yes.
Well, they called that the comedy boom in the 80s.
It was.
And they called this the comedy boom.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference?
You know what? The difference is is that there is a show called Make Me Laugh.
Okay.
At the end of the 70s, hosted by Bobby Van. Can anybody back me up on that? And it was a game show where two contestants would come out, and there was a panel of 3 comedians, and they'd come out for a minute and try to make the person laugh. If they laughed, then they won points or whatever.
No, that's brutal.
Gonna bring that back. But because of that, suddenly all these comedy clubs opened up, because I think before that, stand-up was more kind of a nightclub thing.
Yeah, I feel like the live element of stand-up is taken away a lot more now. It's more TV comedy. You see a lot more specials. Like when I was younger, I remember there'd be like 2 specials a year, like George Carlin and then maybe Eddie Murphy or maybe Chris Rock or something like that.
Or Pryor or
whatever, or Cosby.
Right.
But... But no, they pick, you know, like 2 or 3 specials. Now there's so many. Like, all my friends have specials. Everybody's doing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because of Comedy Central and the internet and all that. But I think it's great. I mean, I love stand-up. I miss it. I wouldn't go back to it. It's funny, Judd Apatow is doing stand-up full-time now, which,
right.
God bless him. I don't know. It's a different... It's a young man's game.
Funny you say that, because I remember when Judd first started going to the Comedy Cellar, and I would be doing comedy, and he'd be there with his legal pad, like nervous, and he'd be like, I don't know if they, and I'm like, hey man, you're Judd Apatow, you'll be fine. But it's weird that comedy, that comedy fear never goes away. When you're on that stage, if you don't have jokes, it doesn't matter what you've done.
Oh no.
You still get scared.
That's still my most reoccurring nightmare, is that I've agreed to do stand-up and get up on stage and have like an hour to fill, and I'm like, I don't have anything. And then I try to fake my way through it, and it starts to get laughs, and then it's kind of like tonight.
Well, that's why we brought notes.
Excellent.
I always feel like stand-up is like swimming, where it works out every muscle in show business, right? Like it's a little bit of acting in there, there's a little bit of improv in there, there's a little bit of stage presence, it's a little bit of everything, it gets you stronger. How does it help writing and directing?
It's everything. Film. I'm telling you, it's everything, because literally I realize that I do put my movies together the exact same way I used to do my set.
Really?
Yep, because you write it, you kind of come up with a thing, and then, you know, so that's basically the, you know, writing and shooting, in which you kind of, what you have to do with shooting, though, is, and you learned this over the years, I did, you have to have enough material so you can trade it out. So that's why we do a lot of improv, we do a lot of alt jokes, we have the writer with us usually, and then a few other writers writing things. And then we let the actors improv, and I'm coming up with the stuff so that we have so much material. Then when you get into post, that's really like working a stand-up act.
Gotcha.
You know, so you go, so we'll put them up like every 2 to 3 weeks, put up a new cut of the movie, and see, okay, these jokes didn't work, these ones worked, and we record it just like I used to record my set. And you hear the laughs and take it into the editing room, because you'll always sit around and go like, I think that joke got a laugh. It's like, well, let's listen to the tape. And then just hear like a little titter, and you're like, okay, we'll pull that one out.
Well, see, that's the difference with, I feel like stand-up, which makes it so exciting is the immediacy of is this good or not? You know, like with filmmaking, you won't know until it opens.
Yeah.
Even, you know, it doesn't matter. Sometimes some people could say it's good and then it doesn't turn out good. Or somebody could say it's bad and then it turns out to be amazing.
Yeah.
And the people love it. So, like, how do you balance that trade-off of being on stage and getting a laugh immediately and knowing if it's funny the moment you say it and waiting a year or 6 months or whatever for a movie to open?
It's weird. I mean, it is, you almost have to kind of manufacture this sort of time machine for yourself, in which when you're there, it's like you're kind of trying to make yourself laugh. Mm-hmm. I've given up on trying to make the crew laugh because it's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
A lot of times when the crew's cracking up, you have like end up having like the worst movie ever.
Yeah. It's usually really dirty.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
For some reason, the crew loves dirty jokes.
Also, we do so many takes and we do so much stuff that usually by the end of our take, they just hate all of us, basically,
right.
You know, because we're all cracking up, and you can just see everybody. Nobody thinks it's funny. When we did Spy, it was hilarious because we shot in Budapest, and so half our crew was Hungarian, and I mean, not a laugh out of nothing. Nothing. And it infected my American crew, so we kind of ended like, and cut. Nothing?
Yes.
Okay. So literally, I ended that thing going like, I might have made the worst movie ever.
But yeah, so then, like, when do you know to trust yourself and trust the material as opposed to trusting who's seen it so far? Because like you said, the crew could be watching and be like, well, this isn't funny because they're Hungarian or they don't understand.
Exactly.
It's lost in translation.
Well, you know, I learned a really valuable lesson when I was at film school at USC because I made this short film. You know, we in our second semester, we had to make kind of a bigger short film. And what you're supposed to do is they give you an allotment of film, and then you're supposed to kind of shoot it over the course of several weekends. I, of course, overachiever, I got in there, I shot my entire movie the first weekend, so the teacher was really upset with me. So he kind of hate-watched it with the class. But what happened was, so he puts it up, and they're watching all this stuff, and I remember he, like, turns to the class after we finished, and he goes, like, well, was it funny? And people are like, no, I didn't think it was funny at all. And I was just sitting there like, fuck all you people. Because because you realize it's like, obviously if somebody says a funny line, it's funny. But
right.
It's all about juxtaposition. It's about the timing. It's about how you put it together.
Yes.
And so, of course, then when we did the screening of it when we finished it, it had all the sound effects. And then everybody's like, oh, my God, it's so funny. And again, you feel like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
But you just realize it's all such a part of it. So that's why you have to be just kind of like eye on the prize the whole time. Like, I think this will be funny. I think this will work. Getting everybody's opinion. All the actors. I rely on the actors so much because
right.
That's why I like to hire funny people. Because
right.
You know, nothing makes me happier than after we'll do a bazillion takes and I'm like, okay, stop. You know, somebody will go like, oh, can I try one thing? It's like, yes. Because so many times that's what you end up using.
Yeah, well, you said something very interesting about he's asking the audience, was this funny? Now, with comedy, it's very dependent on the environment in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
When it's a tense environment, nothing was funny, you know? Like, it could be really funny, but the audience isn't into it just because they're not warmed up for it.
Yeah.
But do you think that hurts sometimes when you're trying to present something and the crowd is already against it before they've even embraced it?
Yeah, I mean, kind of across the board. I mean, it goes all the way into production because if the room's too hot, if it's this, that people
right.
are in a bad mood, if it's too early, anything, you know, that's why you just have to go, like, you know, just don't think about
just
it.
Just go straight
do
through
your
with
thing.
It.
And then, you know, I rely on test screenings like crazy. I mean, I'll actually, the DGA gives you like 10 weeks to kind of do your director's cut before the studio gets to see it. And so, you know, generally you just kind of spend 10 weeks finishing, you know, a cut of your movie. I found over the years I can't do that because if I sit with something for 10 weeks, I'm in love with every cut, every frame. I'm like, oh, don't touch it. Versus I'll try to get in front of a test audience as soon as I can, usually like 4 weeks in, so that you're not in love with it. You're just kind of like, I think this works. I think these are good. Let's try it. Let's see what's working. And then it's much easier to kind of go, all right, take that out, throw that out, because you fall in love with so much stuff.
Yeah, I always feel that way. I feel that way the opposite. Like when we're working on the show, the more I see it, the more I'm like, oh, this isn't gonna work at all. I don't even know why I thought this was funny. But you feel like the things you're most excited about is the stuff that you just came up with and you're still laughing about it because you want to retell it until you retell it and then you tell your friends and they're like, yeah, okay.
Exactly. Well, also the other thing is just, it's the lightning in a bottle aspect of comedy.
Right.
In which, that's why I like improv, and I don't rehearse, I don't do rehearsals.
Really?
No, I'll just kind of like, okay, we're gonna be here, let's light it. And then, you know, say just roll, because I've had something, you know, sometimes the camera guys are like, you know, like, can we just do one just in case? And it's magic happens, and you don't have it, then you never get it back. So yeah, so it's basically just kind of, just kind of letting this happen so that that energy comes across. I mean, you know, if you look at like Bridesmaids, that opening scene between Maya and Kristen in the coffee shop, that was just 5 hours of two cameras, you know, rolling on them at the same time. You know, and the scene was completely scripted, but just it was like, let's play here, let's play there, and, you know, like talk about sex, and at one point, like, imitate a penis, you know, and all of a sudden Kristen does this thing. And it's so funny because they're in the moment. And so right. You just, that energy and that chemistry, you don't need all these expositional lines of like, oh, Annie, I've known you for 20 years, and, you know.
And it also helps that it's Kristen and Maya who've worked with each other for so long,
yeah,
on so many different times.
Yeah.
So they have that kind of built-in chemistry where they know what makes the other one go.
Yeah, that was very calculated. I mean, I love to hire people that have kind of the same relationship as their characters do on the screen. You can't always do it, obviously.
Right, right.
But especially for Kristen going into her first movie, and you know, we just knew that she and Maya were so close.
Right.
And it just, I mean, you know, they just lit up the screen.
Yeah. Well, how's the writing process different for when you, because you've written drama and directed drama, and you've written comedy and directed comedy. What is the, going into it, how you differentiate? Because I always feel like great comedy has to have an element of drama, like a big element of drama, and vice versa. Great drama has to have some sort of humor.
Yeah, very much so. In the beginning, when you're breaking the story, I don't face it any different way. I always say that whenever I'm writing a comedy, we're basically writing a drama, and then we're going to kind of bring the funny up, because I find that comedies that start being written as a comedy, then you have to kind of drill down for the emotion, and that's why you get a lot of comedies that come out of kind of like they're crazy, and then suddenly you get this super maudlin scene, and you know, like towards the third act, and you're like, oh, okay. So I find if you just kind of organically plot it that way, but you need, you know, you have to have a strong story, and you have to have real stakes.
Right.
I mean, that's why I like playing in genres. I had so much fun doing Spy, and you know, and also on The Heat, because I loved like Beverly Hills Cop and 48 Hours, where you watch those movies, they're really, really dark. I mean, there's like an execution at the beginning of like Beverly Hills Cop or something. So you're like, oh shit, like these guys can get killed.
This guy's best friend just got murdered in front of him, and that's the most successful comedy of all time.
But you need that, you need those stakes, because you want to be worried. You know, you want to, that fear kind of makes the comedy funnier. Because if you try to do a comedy that's just all jokes, joke to joke, it just becomes, you better have the funniest jokes in the world. And even then it's hard. I mean, have you ever, and I hate to say this because I love this movie, but there's a movie called Mr. Hulot's Holiday with Jacques Tati, which is brilliant, but at the same time, at the beginning it says, there is no story to this, and it's all just these, and it's great, but it does kind of, you're like, wow, how long is this movie? And it's not that long. It's awesome. But again, it was kind of this thing. I go like, Paul Feig slams Jacques Tati.
I didn't see it. It wasn't at the Magic Johnson Theater. So. But they started that way? That's kind of...
Yeah, which is kind of cool. That was the moment I realized, wow, I need a story to propel me forward so I care about what's coming next, and I care about, you know, about the characters.
Well, the thing I like most about your movies is that, especially in those comedies, is that you find a way to connect with, like, the jokes are funny because you connect with the person. It's like very real people that you know, like Freaks and Geeks and Brides. Like, I know all of those people in those movies, but I don't know anybody that's ever shit in a sink. But somehow it still connects.
That you know of.
Right. That I know of. But somehow it's
you
still...
know me, Michael.
But it's amazing how you could go that far, you know, in comedy, but still keep the characters grounded.
Well, you
I
have
do
to,
that.
You have to have investment in the characters. This is how I kind of explain it in a way, which is two scenarios. One, you're at a restaurant with all your friends you've known forever, and you guys are just cracking each other up. You're having the greatest time. Everybody's making everybody laugh with personal stories and telling stuff, and you're just going bananas, having the greatest time. scenario number two, you're seated at the table next to those people by yourself, and you're just like, what the fuck? Who are these people? They're so not funny.
Yeah.
That story's not funny. These people are so obnoxious. It's because you have no investment in those people.
Right.
So what you have to do out of the gate is you've got to make an audience be best friends with the characters in your movie. Because if once they care, then they go, oh, it's so funny that that happened, because, you know, so much of comedy is also a subverting of expectations. So you go like, oh, I know that character's this way. Oh my God, it's so funny that he did this. Just like in a personal story, you know,
right.
Oh, Susie's so shy, and oh my God, I can't believe she yelled at that guy. That's so out of character, you know, and then that's much funnier.
Yeah, I feel like in most of the worst stories ever told, like just in casual conversations, are about people that I know nothing about.
Yeah.
Like my mother famously tells the worst stories and worst jokes, because she starts with the funny part,
right,
and then gives you the backstory later. And you're like, oh, you gotta understand why it's funny. You're like, no, you gotta tell me why it's funny. I don't know these people.
And then she repeat the punchline over and over again.
And then she repeats the punchline. Like, she sprinkles it in the middle,
right,
and you're like, well, this isn't good.
Well, my favorite is always somebody goes like, I've got the funniest story to tell. He's like, why would you ever do that?
Yeah, just tell the freaking story.
Well, you know what the hardest thing to do in comedy is to portray someone who is funny that people in the movie think is funny. If you want to portray a funny person, you have to have them being funny, and everybody around them in the movie has to be going like, what an idiot. Shut
right.
up, you're not funny. Because if I got caught in this once when I was an actor, I was on a TV show called Dirty Dancing, the TV series. It existed. And I was the added-on character. You know, remember when like they had a cartoon for like the Brady Bunch and the Partridge Family? They'd add like, you know, dancing pandas or a magical bird. I was that character. And I was Norman the Crazy Bellhop who wanted to be a stand-up.
Oh, man.
And so the pilot episode was about, like, we were all auditioning for a talent show, and I get up at the auditions and I bomb completely. But then Baby, played by Melora Hardin, who I ended up directing many years later on The Office, then she coaches me how to be a stand-up, which is hilarious. So at the end, they said, okay, you can write your act for the, you know, so it took place in the 50s. So I write all these jokes about like 50s cars and stuff. And so I get up on stage and I'm doing—
Oh, that's just worth it, right?
Yeah, totally. Worth the price of admission. So I get up and I do this act. And kind of, so we're watching the pilot. And so I'm up stage doing these dumb jokes, and they had directed everybody in the audience to be like, ah! I remember there's like one cut to this guy, he's like, ah! Like losing his shit. And I remember my dad goes, he goes, that joke wasn't funny. And it's like, oh God. So I learned you cannot portray a funny person.
No,
being
man,
laughed at.
That tracks, because I watch like clips of people in the 50s, like when they're watching like the Beatles or something like that for the first time, and they're just losing their shit. And it's like, I want to hold you. It's a good song, but relax. Okay, we get it. Let's not go nuts there. So I feel like that was more accurate.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I had a question too about you and TV, because you did a lot of film as an actor in TV.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still get recognized for like Sabrina or like Heavyweights? Because like as a kid, I remember, I'll see people, I'll meet them later and not put it together. And I'm like, oh shit, that's Puffy. Like, so do you still get like...
Occasionally, yeah, it's those two. It's Sabrina, I'll get recognized for. Once I was on the subway in London, and somebody recognized me from that, because I guess it plays over there. And then, yeah, occasionally Heavyweights, but it fortunately doesn't happen very often.
But isn't that kind of cool, though? Like, you could have done something 20 years ago or 25 years ago, and it still resonates with people. It's still, like, immediately they recognize it.
Well, that's what I love about recorded medium, for lack of a better term. You know, because I'm always drawn to, like, I want to do a play or something like that, but one of the reasons why I stopped doing stand-up, because, you know, you'd have a great show, and then kind of, like, the next night it's like, oh, I got to start this over again.
Yeah.
And if you don't, it's like, God, what did I do different from before? And what I love about anything like that is you get it right once. And what you get right sometimes is just the thing that nobody knew was going to happen that could never be repeated. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I'll go up to Melissa McCarthy after like a long series of takes and go, oh, it was so funny we did this. And she goes like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right.
Like, I don't remember doing that.
Yeah.
And she watches the movies kind of like, when did I do that? Which is, I love that. Because then you get in that state. And so that's why I love just the fact that you do it once and it could live on hopefully forever.
What about the opposite? Does it ever happen where you see something or like I know sometimes I'll write a joke and I'll record that joke, you know, on a stand-up or whatever. And then a year later, I'll have another punchline or another direction for it. And I'm like, oh, I wish I still had that. Does that ever happen with you in movies where you're like, man, I wish I had that movie again because that scene, this would have made it or this would have been different.
It's almost impossible to watch what you've done in the past. I haven't seen most of my stuff. I mean, I haven't seen Freaks and Geeks since it came out, really, and Bridesmaids. I had to watch it recently just because I did taught at a film school, and so they wanted to watch it with me. And it was just, but even that, you're kind of like, oh God, you know, there's just things you see. Like, oh, this is so slow.
That no one else sees,
nobody
by
else
the way.
Sees. No, totally. One else sees it. But I mean, that's, it's an interesting thing because just making any kind of art in general, if we dare call what we do art, is that we as creators have something in our head that we see. And you're like, oh my God, I see that, or it's a, you know, something you would write or something. And to us, that's the perfect thing. And then as you start to do it, however, if you're making a film and you're, you know, compromising and people won't do this and that and things aren't working out, you just go, oh God, it's getting compromised, it's getting worse. It should have been so great. And what I just have to force myself to remember is nobody knew what was in my head. Nobody saw what I saw. Right. And because of that, you just go, like, you just got to take what's there. You try to make it as best as you can. You try to get as close to that vision. But sometimes I found I'm hanging onto a vision over here, and I got all these amazingly talented people over here who are, it's going this direction because that's the direction it should be going.
Right.
And to get in the way of that is ridiculous. That's why I don't have a lot of patience for a lot of writer directors who just are just so, don't move off the script, don't do this. You know, I know some really great actor, improv actors, and they did a movie with a filmmaker like this, and I said, you guys must have had so much fun. And he said, we had the worst time ever because this person would not let us deviate one phrase off of it. And I go, like, why would you possibly hire talented people? If you're gonna do that, then just hire people who aren't known for, you know, having that skill.
Well, that kind of brings to my next question, because a lot of people know you for having strong female leads in your movies, you know, like Bridesmaid and like Spy. And it's weird as a comedian because, like, I'll see it and I'll be like, oh man, Ghostbusters with Leslie Jones and Kate McKinnon. Like, those that's like the funniest people I know, you know? So does it ever like stop you in your tracks? Like, oh yeah, I didn't even realize that this would be looked at as a female lead driven movie as opposed to just happen to be four of the funniest people on camera sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of both. I mean, when I got in the business, I just got so frustrated, and even before I was in the business, just watching things, especially comedy, and just women had such terrible roles, you know, especially because growing up, I was watching with my mom these movies in the 30s and the 40s with, you know, Rosalind Russell and Katherine Hepburn and all, you know, and they were really equals to the men. And then I just watched it just devolve into kind of women were just eye candy, or they were, you know, perfect, or they were mean. And so it was a reaction to that also, because I knew so many funny women, and I'd see them in movies. I remember seeing Sarah Silverman pop up in School of Rock. Great movie, but then, oh God, Sarah's so funny. And like, she's not funny at all in that movie. They just make her be this really mean girlfriend. And it's kind of like, well, that's not fair. Like, why does she not get it to be funny either?
And she's as capable as any comedian in that movie.
I mean, my God, totally. Right. And so it was, that kind of drives me. And then it's also just going like, there's all these funny women who just, and there's not enough roles for them. And then selfishly, I have more fun working with funny women because I'm not like a guy's guy. I like hanging out with guys and I like the humor of guys, but it's not where my brain goes. So like if guys are throwing around a lot of dick jokes, I'm just kind of, you know, oh, that's funny, but I'm not even participate really. Versus there's something about the funny women I know, there's just a different kind of
complexity.
Yeah, and a dynamic to it. I find it to be fun. And it doesn't mean it's like it's all good natured. I mean, obviously, you know, Sarah and Amy, you know, Schumer and all these people can get down and dirty as any of them. But
good natured is not how I would describe
Leslie Jones.
Two. No, Leslie Jones isn't exactly the good natured Leslie Jones.
But they're just, I don't know, I just, there's a different dynamic that I really enjoy about it. And I just love telling these stories.
Is it also maybe because as a man, like when you're hearing these kinds of jokes, it's like, oh man, is it harder to write for women than it is to write for men being a man?
I mean, I never so bold as I know how to write women. I feel more comfortable writing women, but I don't ever say I can write the perfect woman's part. I can write sort of the surroundings of it,
right,
in the situation for it, but then I really rely on the women around me. First, my wife is the first one, Lori, who reads everything first, yeah, and then my producing partner, Jesse Henderson, and then, I always have a lot of other, women around, but then I really rely on the actresses in the movie.
Right.
Because I want them, the only rehearsals I ever do are like a month or two before we go into production. We'll just read through and then they'll improv just so I can start to hear what their take is on the character, and then I can go in, or whoever wrote the script can go in, and then we can redo it so that when they get to the set, they just slide right in.
I gotta tell you, as a performer, you might not want to talk about this, but it's like, seriously, I remember finding out that like Melissa and Leslie and them were gonna be in Ghostbusters, and I was like, holy shit. And people, there was backlash for it, internet backlash, I guess. Mm. But it was as if you were just taking four women off the street. We're like, these are still the funniest people. Like, who's gonna be funny? Like, name four other actors that would be funnier or better performers for this kind of role. So it must have been frustrating just to be like, what? I'm giving you.
Yeah, it is frustrating just because you're like, why is there any kind of a litmus test on this?
Yeah, it's not like you're taping it over the old Ghostbusters.
No, not. Yeah.
That copy still exists, I'm certain. Right?
I know. A lot of people thought, they thought I was for some reason. No, it was, I don't know. I was just coming out of film school,
right,
in my early 20s when Ghostbusters came out. We went to see opening weekend, and I thought it was hilarious. And it's like, oh my God, what an amazing idea for a movie. But that was kind of it for me. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was like religion for like sort of the generation of boys after me, And it turned out it was the ultimate boys movie for some weird reason. A lot of guys, this is like, it was their thing. And so I didn't realize what a sacrilegious thing I did, which is kind of like, oh, come on, guys, grow up.
It's strange, especially like you're a comedian and you're a writer and you're a director. Your life's in comedy. My life's in comedy. We love comedy.
Yeah.
We do comedy all the time. Mm-hmm. But even us, we're like, well, it's a movie about Ghostbusters. So like, who's like, okay, there's four women are fighting ghosts. And you're like, women? That's not realistic. Fighting ghosts.
I know.
Well, it's just bizarre.
No, it is weird. I kind of hope that now we're a year past it coming out. I get so many people really love the movie. Plenty of people don't like the movie too. But so many people really love the movie, and it's when I get contacted by women and girls who are now interested in science and are going into science, and like women will write me and say, if I had this movie when I was a kid, I would have been an engineer by now. Like, that's when you go, like, that's, it's important to be able to show these, women in science, women in STEM. I would love to do more of that because I work with Gina Davis's foundation a lot, and Gina has that thing of you can see it, you can be it. And there's so many women on TV portraying forensic scientists that apparently, like, the forensic science, education is booming with women because they see it. And so it's like, so the more, roles you can put up of women in these professional, careers, it seems to help,
I mean, as a minority, I feel like it's the same thing where you see a lot of different black leads with certain roles, and it definitely does have an effect on kids.
Yeah.
I could imagine women it's the same way when they're watching, oh wow, I could be a action star, and not just like a lady action star,
right.
I could be a fucking action star. And it has to mean something.
Yeah, and it's always, I just love that we were able to do them non-sexualized too. I wanted them just in these, uniforms, and that's, I have so many guys will kind of write me angrily on the internet and go like, well, we really like the Wonder Woman trailer, so I guess we're misogynists, huh? They're like, we really liked Harley Quinn, so I guess we're, it's like, well, yeah, but her ass cheeks are hanging out and her boobs. So it's kind of like, okay, that's fine, but It's like it's not really proving your credentials as a feminist with that.
Exactly. I didn't exactly like Harley Quinn, I'm not gonna lie to you.
Well, past that part of it, was it intimidating taking on like a franchise, mm-hmm. like an already established? As a writer, you always want to put your print on it, and as a director, you want to put your stamp on it. But being that there's already kind of there's rules already set for it, you know, there's a world already created for it. How do you break free from what we've already seen and make something that's original but still true to the script, but still true to the concept?
I mean, it was tough. I the minute I had the idea to do it, I said I got to call Katie Dippold because, you know, she's one of the greatest writers I know, and also she loves horror movies, she loves mm-hmm. ghost stories, she loves all that thing. So we kind of kicked it back and forth a bunch, and you know, my first instinct was just like pretend, just throw everything out and let's start over. But it's like no, you know, Katie was saying, and then I was agreeing with her. It's like if we went to see this and it wasn't us that made it, like what would we be excited to see, and what would we be bummed if we didn't see?
Right.
You know, that laundry list comes up pretty quick. You want to see the Ecto-1, you want to see the proton packs, right, and, you know, right. Then go with Slimer would be fine. And so, you know, we started throwing it in. Maybe we threw in a few too many. A lot of critics kind of took us apart for that. But at the same time, we do these test screenings. Every time any reference came up, people would really, like, they would cheer.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of fun to do it that way. But it's intimidating taking on any kind of a franchise like that. I mean, I doubled up because Ralph here? Hey Ralph. Ralph is, and Steve, hey, Steve, oh my God, Steve, oh, well.
What's up, guys?
Director and producers of the Peanuts movie are here. Exactly. And they very kindly let me come on as a producer on that. And that was, so I really doubled up on two beloved childhood things.
I friggin' love the Peanuts.
It was great, I'm telling you. I mean, but for me, for both those things, you come on like, I love these things so much, I want to protect them and make sure they don't, you know, become something they're not supposed to be, and, you know.
I can relate, man, and this is going to sound crazy, but I can kind of relate in my own small way, because I always feel like whenever you're taking on something that people have already seen, you're not going to make everybody happy.
Right.
You're just not. It's like a stepdad kind of thing. Where it takes, because I started on Weekend Update,
and
you're replacing someone that someone's already in love with, and it, you know, it's constant. Well, SNL's a little bit different because that's the only constant is change, you know, at that show. Mm-hmm. No one's there for 43 years, but except for Lauren. but I mean, it is tough stepping in because it's like, well, he's just not doing what I'm used to seeing.
Yeah.
And this isn't the Ghostbusters, or this isn't the Peanuts that I would have done. So it's always, you kind of go in knowing you're not going to please everybody, but you're kind of just want to make something cool for the next generation to fall in love with.
Yeah, totally. And you, I mean, how was that transition for you? Because
you're
on social media. Yeah, exactly.
No, it's fun. It's once you understand that, then it's fun because you know that it's not personal. It's sometimes they just miss what they used to see.
Yeah, and I'm such a people pleaser that was the hardest thing for me to kind of deal
with. It's tough, right?
Yeah, really tough. Because also, I'm, you know, before Ghostbusters, I had this like really lovely relationship with the internet. You know, it's always very nice and back and forth. And so when that first volley of just terribleness came in, I'm just like, well, I mean, honestly, it kind of threw me off for a couple of years. I just wasn't used to it, and. Whereas now, if I could go back in a time machine now, I would have gone just don't even read it, you know, just put it away.
Yeah.
And I never would have referenced it. That was the biggest mistake I made was, you know, a year in, I took on one of the trolls, and then that just, you know, they can fire at you for a year. If you dare say one thing back, it's all over. You, they're victims, and you're a monster.
It's so crazy. And then they're like, why? Because the attitude is always like, well, why would you even respond? You're like, well, who wouldn't respond to people yelling at you for no reason?
Oh, I know.
That's like a weird thing that you'd have to just be used to.
Yeah.
Even when you do something like that you love, you're like, well, you could still get one or two, and you can't tell them to go fuck off.
Well, you know what it is? Because you go into it so like pure of spirit. You know, I was like, we're just trying to do something. We're so excited and like just wanted to make everybody happy. And you're like, oh no, it's a very weird thing, but it toughens you up. I mean,
it does.
I never wanted to be toughened up. So it's kind of like, God damn it. Why do I have to have a thick skin now?
No, man.
My hardened heart.
Well, one of the dope things about Bridesmaids, which I just found this out, I didn't even know this, was Melissa was nominated for an Oscar. I didn't even know that. I don't know why. I didn't know that.
And Kristen and Annie were nominated for Best Screenplay, too.
That's insane.
Isn't that crazy?
For comedy, especially.
Yeah.
Why do you think comedy isn't as respected by the, I don't know, I don't even know what to call it, like the highbrow.
Right.
Kind of society that gets to pick, oh, this is fine film, and comedy seems like the hardest thing. Anybody that ever works in show business always says, well, comedy's the hardest thing to do, yet it's never rewarded in that way.
Well, I'll tell you exactly why, my friend. Because when comedy is done right, it looks easy. It has to look easy. Because you know what's sweaty. Sweaty is a word we use in comedy all the time. You go, oh God, that joke's so sweaty. Because it just, you see it working so hard. And you know, it's the reason why Steve Carell never won an Emmy for his performance on The Office.
Which is a crime.
Which is a crime, because he made it look so easy. And I would talk to people, and they're like, well, what, he just shows up, he's just crazy. It's like, are you crazy?
Yeah.
This guy works so hard to be that character. It's not who he is at all. But that's the thing. And so comedy at its best is completely not showy. You know, and the comedies that tend to break through are more kind of, I don't know, they don't really that much. But it was a great, that was a great lesson for me, because I think the worst thing that can happen to a filmmaker is when they want to win awards, because you start serving many different masters when you do that. And when we made Bridesmaids, the last thing we thought was, okay, we're going to win an award. So we just went into it trying to make the best movie we could. The fact that we got nominated, I was like, oh, that's how it should work. Just try to make the best thing you do.
Yeah.
And if it comes, it comes. But like, if you're doing Oscar bait, I'm not a fan of that. I want to entertain the audience.
And I think also that's a very comedy thing, because the reward is always even bigger than the Oscar, is making people laugh.
Yeah.
Like you can make a comedy that's not funny to people, but win an award and you've made an unsuccessful movie. You've made a successful movie, but a very unsuccessful comedy.
Right.
You know, so there's a lot of people like, oh, this movie, you got to see, it's hilarious. And there's two jokes in it, but it won an Oscar. Go fuck yourself. But and that's another thing with comedic performers, they say, oh, they're just playing themselves.
Yeah.
Which is like, no, no, it's not the case.
Yeah. Just go to any stand-up night, open mic night, and see how hard it is for
it's
people
very,
to be truly
very,
funny.
Very, very tough. But I think that's kind of awesome. That's kind of a feather in your cap to be able to put something out that even passed that prejudice of comedy.
No, it's really nice. That's what, you know, I like the Golden Globes, because they actually have a comedy section in it, although you still can lose to Trump.
Yeah.
Spy Loss of the Martian. Martian's a great movie, but
right.
Not the funniest movie I've ever seen.
No.
And I like that comedy and musical are in one category, too. Like, I guess singing and laughing is the same thing, apparently.
Polar opposites. Well, what's that feeling when you do Bridesmaids and it like just breaks records? It was the highest grossing female driven R-rated movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's
which is a weird thing to keep track of.
Exactly. It's a lot of qualifiers there, my friend.
But I mean, but that's still like, it's a big deal.
Well, it's,
do you feel vindicated? Do you feel like, is it nerve-wracking? Like, oh shit, is this my bar now?
Right. Well, it's all relief. I tell you, it's just
okay.
So much relief, because when you're making a movie, that's all you think about. It's all keeps you up at night is, what if this movie doesn't do well? Because I've been there. I was in movie jail. I made two movies that were hugely unsuccessful.
Movie jail?
Movie jail. Yes,
it
exists.
What's movie jail?
Movie jail is when...
I've heard you say this before, and I never wanted to ask because I wanted to look smart.
It's a simple thing, movie jail. It means you make a movie and everybody's into you, and like the studio's, oh, well, he's great, we're going to do all these other things, and then the movie comes out and doesn't do well, and suddenly you go, hey, what about those other jobs? And you're like, oh, no, no.
Oh.
And then you're boom, and then you're in there, and they don't let you out easily. And fortunately I was doing TV directing too. So I had a point right after I did this Christmas movie in 2006 that bombed, called Unaccompanied Minors. And check it out. And so I went back into TV, but I remember just kind of feeling like, well, that's it. Because I remember the most sobering moment was, you know, I'd done Freaks and Geeks, created Freaks and Geeks and all that stuff. And you know, so I knew my way around stories about kids and all that.
Yeah.
So like about a year or two after Uncoming Miners had bombed, I was up for Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which I love those books. I think they're so funny. And I was like, oh, cool, I want to do this. And got all the way to the top. Like, I had the job. And then all of a sudden, the word came down. Oh, actually, they don't want you. And it was just like, wow, that was hardcore scary movie jail. Because you're like, if I can't even do the thing that I'm kind of known for,
wow,
then it's over. And then thank God for Judd. I mean, who would, you know, ask me to come to a reading of what would become Bridesmaids. Like a few years before, it's like 3 years before we actually did it, because he knew I loved working with female characters and all that. And he was basically saying, you know, come and check this out. So we watched it. And I was so excited because, like, here's this table of all these really funny women, you know, completely different than we used. Although Melissa was at that table read playing completely different characters, and I didn't know her. I didn't know Melissa until I met her auditioning for Bridesmaids.
Right.
But I was really excited about it. But then it kind of just went away for a few years because Kristen was busy on SNL and the studio wasn't sure. And you know, so then when I, you know, when that got set up, he let me out of movie jail, which was nice. And you know, but that, I always called
that
movie.
I'm still in that movie jail. I love that.
But I always refer to that movie as Strike Three because the whole thing, because I had two big strikes and go, like, if I blow it again, then forget it. Like, they probably wouldn't even let me direct TV anymore. So it was very, very much a relief when it did well.
Not to sidetrack too far, but yes, you did Freaks and Geeks. Was that you, or was that kids you knew?
It was both.
Because I look at you now, you don't look like a freak or a geek. You're very,
why,
very
you,
stylish man.
Thank you.
I can't imagine you had a rough time in high school.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No. Really?
You look. Really, you look cool. Like if you were dressed like this in high school right now, I'd be like, fuck, that's a cool ass 16-year-old. You look cool.
Thank you, my friend. No, high school was rough, but also I, you know, I found my group. That's why the biggest sort of issue I had when I created Freaks and Geeks was the name, because I was like, because we used to call the Burnouts Freaks. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I want to do that. And I said, oh, but the nerds, but oh, geeks. Well, geeks rhymes with freaks. But I was like, no, I want to call us geeks because we never, that word wasn't around. We didn't think of ourselves as nerds. There was like nerds in our school,
right,
that were like, you know, like central casting nerds.
Yeah.
They carry the briefcase and you know, all that stuff. And, but we were just kind of awkward.
Yo, yeah.
That was always the sign back when I was in high school, like the guy with the briefcase is so fun. And I was given a briefcase, and then I graduated from high school. It's like, what do they think of me?
Oh, man.
In 10 pen and pencil sets, too. But yes, so that was my group, was kind of like, we were just the awkward kids who used to talk about Monty Python and, you know, old comedies and recite lines from them back and forth. But then we got to know the Burnouts, too. So Sam was really based on me, and then Lindsay was based on the sister I always wanted. I was an only child, and I always wished I had an older sister. And so I kind of invented, like, who would my perfect older sister be? And it was Lindsay. And then all the other characters were based on people I knew or amalgamations of them. But once you cast, then you really change it to
right,
fit those people. But the kind of the dynamics of the archetypes were based on people I knew.
That, which brings me to another question that I had. When you have characters, or when you have a cast like Melissa, or, you know, such strong, dynamic performers, how do you change up the writing or change up the direction of that character and let them kind of evolve with it, as opposed to what you had on the paper?
Well, it is a process. That's why I do those rehearsals like a month or two out, because
right,
you know, we write it, and I kind of have somebody in mind, but like Spy, I didn't think that was gonna be for Melissa at all, because I thought I was going to make it in a certain window when she was off doing her TV show. Mm. But when she read it, she loved it, and so we decided to wait. But basically, I kind of like, yeah, we'll read through it, because as much as I think I can write for somebody, you still see them doing things, and you hear a voice that they'll come up with, or they'll come up with an attitude, and that's what, then I can adjust it to them. Like, the interesting thing was actually Rose Byrne when we did Spy, because I, you know, Rose had been in Bridesmaids and was so great. And when I found out that she was available to be in Spy, I said, yeah, come on. But the part wasn't at all written the way for her at all. I kind of wrote it for this sort of, like, it was supposed to be kind of this rich, sort of bratty, like, teenager character. And But then when Rose came in, I was like, well, let's just read through it. And she read it that way, and it was just, it didn't work at all. Not because of her, just because the writing just didn't hold up. And so it was fun, though, because we were with Melissa, and I was like, well, try this, try that, try that. We were trying different voices, different accents, different attitudes. And then just kind of clicked into, like, well, try British. And she did it like this super disaffected thing. So I was like, oh, now actually go back and read the kind of the mean teenage lines like this. And it was super funny because she would just like say the meanest thing in this kind of like way that she thought was being really supportive and cold. And
really
it was so, oh my God, it was so funny. So then it's like, okay, good, go away. Now I'm going to rewrite this to really fit that. And she just, oh my God,
and then it's
she's unbelievable. And then the opposite was when Statham came in, because that was that same session. I finished with them. And Statham came in, and I'm just the biggest Statham fan in the world. My wife and I watched every movie he's ever done. I've always, for years, was like, I gotta get him in a movie. I gotta get him in a movie.
He looks like a drawing of an action star. Like, he's like quintessential.
He's like chiseled out of stone. Like, he bumped into me once. I was like, oh my God, like getting hit by a truck. But the nicest guy in the world. But he came in, and he was kind of nervous, you know, because, you know, he hadn't really done comedy, although he has. If you've seen, what's the movie? Not Snatched. Crank.
Crank. Oh, okay.
Those are comedies, and he knows they're comedies. Right. They're so crazy, those movies. But he came in, and I was like, okay, well, just read through. And he goes like, no, I shouldn't do this funny or anything. I said, no, play it dead serious. And he read through that, and everything he said was so fucking funny. And I just like, do the next thing. Do the next thing. I said, all right, Jason, go, leave. You're done. And I said, don't do anything. And I didn't change anything because he was so funny. But what would happen when we got to the set, then we just started writing crazier and crazier jokes for him. And I kept going like, he's gonna punch me at some point. Because what I would do is I would just sit there. The first thing we did was when he shows up in that hotel room and surprises her, and he's sitting in that chair. So I was just sitting like, he's in the chair, like however you are, and I was just sitting right here, and the camera's right there, and I had these jokes, a whole list of these funny jokes that I had written, and then Katie had written, and another writer we know, Trisha McAlpern, had written, and I'm just like, saying them. It was so funny. Like, I'd say something to him and he would just crack up. And then he'd like try it once and he didn't get it right. And then he'd do it the second time and it was just perfect. And so everybody starts handing in more jokes and they're getting nuts and more nuts. And I just go like, oh my God, is he? And it's like, I'm sitting so close to the guy. But he never turned down one joke and he sold them so hardcore. If you get a chance, on the Blu-ray, or and I think you can get it on the extras on digitally too. Look at some of all the line jokes we didn't use for him, especially in the CIA room. They're some of the dumbest.
Well, that's
jokes in the world. He sells them so hardcore.
That's my favorite thing about like SNL when you get action stars or like our favorite. My favorite hosts are always like action stars or like music people that have no idea what they're doing with comedy. They just want to read the joke because then you can do whatever you want with them. Comedians always second guess. It's like, I don't know if that's going to be funny because we second guess ourselves all the time. But like guys like that, you love. Like there was a sketch written for, it was for, I think Chris Pratt when he hosted. Mm. And it was about Jason Statham, and it was called Jason Statham, Jason Stakeums. And it's literally Jason Statham to camera trying to sell Stakeums. And then he's just explaining how to eat a Stakeum. He's like, you gotta close your mouth normally. It's so funny, written by Tim Robinson and Zach Cannon. It was really funny.
Oh but my God,
yeah, but I always feel like with actors, that's another thing that you do so well, as I think, is that you find a way for not like someone that's not known for their comedic ability to still score by playing straight.
Well, that's the most fun in the world. When you can subvert when you surprise an audience with somebody, it's the greatest feeling in the world. Like, you know, like Hemsworth and
right, exactly.
Ghostbusters. Like, that's so funny. But what's so funny is these guys, and honestly, it's really hard to find somebody who can do it.
Right.
Because you know
they don't trust it.
Well, they don't trust it, or they try to be funny. And when people try to be funny, it's terrible.
It's terrible. Oh, don't try to be funny. Just be scared and straight.
Yeah, sell it straight. You know, but these guys get it. But I remember Chris came to my room like the day before he started shooting. We were already like 6 weeks into production, and he was really nervous. He's like, because he knew he's going up against these titans.
Right.
I mean, Kristen, Melissa, and Kate McKinnon on his first day with this big job interview thing with all these, we're going to want to do all this improv. So I was like, Chris, don't worry. We've got jokes written you will not have to do. I'm just going to call them into you. So he gets there, and he starts fucking improvising, and he's hilarious. I mean, it's like, and the ladies keep looking at me like, does that one of yours? I'm like, it's him. That's, you know, funny. I mean, he came up with all the, like, the Mike hat joke and that whole thing. I was just like, what? But it was also, the fun thing was, what I think helped is I said, when he came on, when I had lunch with him months before, and his accent's so great, I was like, the only thing I want is for you to play it with, just play it as yourself, with your accent. And by doing that, you strip away that some layer where he would be thinking about something else.
Right.
And he's just able to kind of play this doofy version of himself.
He doesn't have to try to score. It's right there for him.
Yeah.
That's kind of. Well, I think we got like a few minutes left, and they wanted to do some questions for the audience. Is that right? If I'm reading my headset.
Well, you have a headset?
Yeah, no, I don't. I'm just high. No, I'm kidding. Well, you had a question, sir.
You gonna do any sequels to these?
Any sequel? I haven't done a sequel yet. It's not because I'm so like, I'll never do a sequel. They just never tend to happen for some reason. Like Bridesmaids, but again, I mean Bridesmaids, it's really up to Kristen. Also, sequels are dangerous because, like, people always want us to do a sequel to, I always say they want a sequel to Bridesmaids, but I'm like, the whole reason that movie worked is because Kristen Wiig was a mess and she kind of learned how to, you know, repair her life.
Right.
So you can't do a sequel and she's a mess again and she has to repair her life again. You know, and then people tend to think, like, it's the artifice around all that is what made the movie great, but it's really, it was that emotional journey. And so you almost kind of have to be, you know, careful of it. That said, yeah, we wrote a sequel to The Heat. Katie Dippold wrote the most hilarious sequel to The Heat, and it's like a takeoff on Silence of the Lambs, because we desperately want to do like a horror comedy. Where she and I are just so set on that, but Sandra didn't want to do it, and then Spy. I mean, I'd love to make another Spy, but it made just not quite enough at the box office to get people excited at the studio about doing it. And then,
I mean, you put Melissa on a poster, though. I'm there.
Nice.
I'm there. So, yeah, I would watch Spy too.
But
course.
Never say never. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
What would you, do you have any tips on how to provide that safe space in a way that's conscious of time and budget and everything?
Yeah.
You have to be conscious of, but also allowing that play.
Yeah, no, because, I mean, I deal with that all the time. Funny, when I did TV, you always like hear these, when you make movies, you have all the time in the world. You have no more time when you do a movie because you're setting up a new thing every day. So we're always against the clock. You just have to be organized with what you're doing, you know? I mean, like, we'll try to get all our, you know, we'll pre, you know, days before, we'll write up all our alts. So I get there and I can literally, okay, try this, try that, try that. I can throw them in, especially if I know I'm on a tight schedule, then it gets a little more just kind of try this. And then I'll do like, you know, then I'll always do like what I call dealer's choice, which, you know, at the end I go, all right, dealer's choice, whatever you want to do. And you can keep it moving along. I mean, it's better if you got tons of time because you can really exhaust it. But also, if everybody knows going in that they, you know, you have that amount of time, you do fill it up. It just, the most important thing is just make sure you get a bunch of options. You know, the danger is going in, you don't have enough time, and so you're like, well, let's just really nail the script. It's like, it's too dangerous. I mean, I can tell you, point to a bazillion examples of things I thought were just going to destroy, and I get put up in front of a test audience and just lays an egg. Mm. And then vice versa, something you're like, I don't know, and then it becomes the biggest joke in the movie. So the biggest thing, just get yourself options, but be organized.
I think we got time for one more. You want to pick?
You right there. Nope, yeah. Yep.
Oh, yeah. I was just curious for both of you, of the recent movies you've seen, what's been your favorite and what stuck with you and why?
Gosh.
Of the recent movies I've seen, I don't get to watch a lot of movies because I'm always working nights and I feel like movies are a little creepy in the daytime. It's more of a nighttime thing, but like I'm always working nights, so I don't get to go out to the movies as often as I like. But I do remember watching Moonlight because I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
It was a recommendation with some people that I was with. I was like, oh, let's go see this. I heard it's good.
Yeah.
And I remember watching that and really liking it.
Yeah, it's so well made. It just everything about the way they shot it, it's so great.
It's really exciting. That's what's so exciting about this festival is that you get to watch movies that you don't really know a lot about, and it's really a surprise as opposed to seeing 6 weeks of coming attractions and 6 weeks of trailers where you're like kind of have an idea of where the jokes are. And this, I didn't know the plot at all. I thought it was a gangster movie.
But when they got to that beach, boy, was I in for it. It's a completely different movie. Caught me off guard.
I thought Get Out was fantastic too. I mean, that's exactly the kind of stuff I love. I love things that are tonally can't be defined, you know? And I struggle with this in all the movies I make because people want it, if it's a comedy, they want it to be a comedy. If it's a horror movie, they want it to be a horror. And like, if you go like, well, no, it's both, they kind of go haywire. So I'm so happy for Jordan. I mean, my God, he just, that was really masterfully done, so.
Yeah, I still haven't seen it, but I'm looking forward to it.
It's really good.
Yeah, I might have to go see that in a day.
I think so, exactly.
Well, I think, do we have time? Are we good, or is that one? Do one more? Is he? All right, let's pick one more, Paul.
Don't put it on me. I always feel bad.
All right, I'll take it.
There you go.
Well, yeah, let's see. Yeah, you.
Hey.
Hello.
So, Paul, first of all, somebody who's made Freaks and Geeks is never in director's jail.
Well, thank you, Rob.
Number two, I loved the movie you made, the Peanuts movie. It's one of my favorites with Steve
Martino.
But also, you produce a lot, like the Peanuts movie. Could you tell us, I think I'd be a bad executive if you didn't talk about Snatched.
Thank you, Rob. Yeah, no, I just produced a movie that's coming out with Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn called Snatched.
Yeah,
and that's from our company.
Shit.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it's great. I mean, Goldie Hawn has not been on the screen for 14 years, and she is so good in this movie. And she and Amy literally think they're mother and daughter. They were so great together. And I just got involved. That was Katie Dippold wrote that when we were just come out of the out of Spy. I was going to direct it originally, and then I got so buried in Ghostbusters that they wanted to make it right when we were finishing that up. That we, you know, ended up, Jonathan Levine ended up doing it, and but it's really great. It's super fun, and it opens on Mother's Day.
Well, that sounds awesome. Paul Feig, ladies and gentlemen.
Michael Che, thank you.
I think that's it. I don't know exactly how to dismount, so we're just gonna warm up awkwardly.
Oh,
thank
boy.
You guys so much.
Thanks.
The Tribeca Film Festival takes place every year in New York City. To learn more about all of our programs, head to TribecaFilm.com.